James McDougall for Governor Clinton at Madison Guaranty Savings and Loan. The majority began the inquiry with a conclusion that there was a quid pro quo involving the fundraiser and a decision of an Arkansas state agency to lease office space for Madison Guaranty. To any fair-minded investigator, two obstacles to reading such a conclusion would be presented. One, the fact that the lease for the office space was entered into more than a full year before the fundraiser. And secondly, the evidence showed that Governor Clinton played no role in selecting the office site or negotiating the terms of the lease. When this evidence was presented at the public hearing, demonstrating the circumstances under which the Madison space was chosen, a member of the majority registered his consternation at this departure from the Republican game plan by exclaiming, "Mr. Chairman, isn't the point here simply to draw a conclusion that the governor played a major role in the selection of this building?" Inconveniently, the evidence once again rebutted the preconceived conclusion. More than finding no abuse of office by Bill Clinton, the evidence gathered by the committee shows that then-Governor Clinton demonstrated independence from political supporters doing business with state governments. There are a number of examples of this in the committee's exhaustive review of Governor Clinton's 12-year tenure as governor. Let me set out just a couple of them as representative of our findings. And the minority has gone through each one of them in our report, discussing them thoroughly and objectively, taking the facts as presented, and seeking to analyze them in a sober and rational way. Let me just give two examples. In 1983, Marlon Jackson, the Arkansas State Banking Commissioner, informed Governor Clinton of bank regulatory problems at the Bank of Kingston, a small bank in northern Arkansas purchased by James McDougall after he left the post in Governor Clinton's first administration. Jackson testified that he mentioned the Bank of Kingston problem as a litmus test to see if the young governor would seek to influence Jackson and obtain favorable treatment for a political supporter. Clinton passed Jackson's test. Jackson testified that Governor Clinton told him, quote, "You do whatever you need to do to be a good, no, to be a great bank commissioner, and don't worry about the political consequences. It doesn't matter who is involved. I'll take the political heat. You just do whatever you need to be a great bank commissioner." 4 years later, in another situation involving the state health officials, in a meeting that Mr. McDougall had requested with the state health department officials and Governor Clinton to present a grievance about unfair treatment by the state sanitarians at one of his real estate developments, McDougall at that meeting attacked the health department officials, accused them of misconduct. Governor Clinton, by all the testimony, supported his state officials at the meeting. He reprimanded McDougall in front of his officials, and more important, after the meeting, Governor Clinton pulled aside Tom Butler, the deputy director of the state health department, and told him, quote, "Do what you have to do and you will not hear another word from me." These examples and others would lead a fair-minded reader to the same conclusion that will follow from a review of the entire lengthy report. Governor Clinton did not misuse his office as governor of Arkansas, and he has not misused his office as President of the United States. The venom with which the majority focuses its attack on Hillary Rodham Clinton is surprising and disturbing even in the context of the investigation. No attempt is made to place into perspective the relative importance to the American people of whether Mrs. Clinton has a specific recollection today of every memorandum, phone call, and detail of every case she has handled in her private law practice in Little Rock more than a decade ago. Every act is portrayed in its most sinister light. Every failure of recollection is treated as though the standard for human experience is total recall and photographic memory. Perhaps the most sensationalized conclusions of the majority involve the handling of Vincent Foster's papers. The crux of the disagreement between White House counsel Bernard Nussbaum and Deputy Attorney General Philip Hyman was whether Nussbaum's insistence on being the one to review Foster's files in the presence of Justice Department lawyers and law enforcement officials would create an unfortunate appearance problem for the White House. Hyman agreed that legally, in his testimony, agreed that the Park police investigators had no right to enter the office and search the files, nor could the Justice Department lawyers obtain a search warrant or subpoena. Now, while Hyman was clearly prescient about the public and political fallout from Nussbaum's decision, who is to say that Nussbaum may also not have perceived something when he expressed the concern that even if Justice Department lawyers had taken part in the search, critics of the administration would simply charge a broader conspiracy. Irresponsible claims of possible obstruction of justice simply ignore the testimony of law enforcement officials who came before the committee. Those officials testified that the investigation into Vincent Foster's death, the only investigation involving the review of the office files, was not obstructed, that the investigators in the end were provided every document or file they requested, that the investigators had absolutely no interest in reviewing financial records involving personal investments of the Clintons, such as Whitewater, and that the investigators' interest was limited to reviewing a suicide note or other information bearing on the cause for Foster's suicide. The majority pursuit of White House officials involved in searching for a suicide note in the aftermath of Foster's death is equally irresponsible. Senator Dodd captured the spirit of this onslaught during one of our hearings last fall, and if he'll excuse me, I'm going to tell his story. I thought it was a very perceptive comment at the time. Senator Dodd, Mr. Chairman, just on this point, and I think it is very important, this gets to the reality. But what I was getting at earlier and what we are doing here in a sense is there are sort of three fact situations. You get a witness that says, well, I don't recall. The immediate accusation is that the witness is being disingenuous. If you have witnesses with conflicting testimony, the allegation is someone's lying. And if you have witnesses that have consistent statements, it's a conspiracy. This is getting ridiculous. So you're trapped no matter what you say. You're either disingenuous, lying, or conspiring. And that's just foolishness. The game of leaking information has marred the committee's credibility throughout these proceedings. Often distorted or even baseless charges have been disseminated through faceless leaks. The recent well-orchestrated leak of the majority report is but part of a pattern. We saw that over this weekend. With the report scheduled to come out today, obviously a carefully planned strategy of leaking the report took place over the weekend. In my own view, the supposed short-term benefits of leaking will be offset by the longer-term diminution of credibility that the majority must suffer for what is obviously a blatantly political attack. In our report, not leaked, released according to the rules, the subject set forth in Senate Res 120 are analyzed according to the testimony and documents presented, and we look forward to the opportunity to present the facts to the American people in contrast to the overheated assertions by the majority which have characterized its approach to this investigation. Not counting our earlier hearings, this committee met for more than 300 hours. It took over 10,000 pages of testimony, 51 hearings, 8 public meetings, 159 witnesses. Hundreds of thousands of pages of documents have been provided to the committee, more than 15,000 from the White House, more than 30,000 from the Clinton's attorney. Others here will speak of the direct costs that have been involved in this Whitewater inquiry by all of the various committees, the independent counsel and others. The figure is now well over $30 million. This has been the longest-running congressional investigation of any sitting president, far longer than Watergate or Iran-Contra, both of which, in contrast to this situation, involved actual abuse of governmental power. The facts gathered by the committee are more than enough to close this chapter. The American people deserve to know, and now can take comfort in knowing, that this year-long investigation shows no misconduct or abuse of power by their president or first lady. And I yield to Senator Bond.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bond. In my view, motivated by politics, conducted in a highly partisan manner in the midst of a presidential election, which has resulted in political conclusions based not on facts, but on a desire to damage the president. The majority report reads more like its summary of the Republicans' wild allegations instead of a true summary of the facts. To use the old adage, the majority is not going to let the facts get in the way of a good story. Certainly, as we note today, it'll be 20 weeks from tonight, or on this day, that people will go to the polls. 20 weeks from today. What we're seeing here should come as no surprise. The Republicans are trailing in the polls, and therefore they will throw as much mud as they can at the First Family. That's all, frankly, the majority report appears to be. 1,000 pages of political invective and printed at taxpayer expense. What is particularly despicable, in my view, is that in the absence of any evidence against the president, the majority has made the conscious, cynical decision to attack Mrs. Clinton for legal work, which was done more than a decade ago. Time and time again, the majority has made clear that they intended to get the First Lady through direct attacks, but also in the form of sly innuendo and nasty implications. Why else did the majority wait 6 months until the very last minute of the committee's life to ask Mrs. Clinton about the billing records when she had offered to answer their questions in January? It's only because they're making one last vain attempt, in my view, to salvage some credibility for themselves by throwing one last glob of mud at Mrs. Clinton and hoping that this time, unlike the others, it might stick. The simple fact is that since we began last year, this has been the most partisan and politicized hearing in the history of the Senate. These hearings were little more than taxpayer-funded opposition research. By conducting themselves in this kind of manner, the majority, in my view, has done far more damage to the institution than they have to the administration. Mr. Chairman, let me just conclude, if I may, with a couple of points, particularly on the leaking. You know, my experience in 22 years has been that if you have something to say, you let the report stand on its own. If you don't have much to say, you leak it, because that's the way you get it printed. That's the way you draw attention to it. And even vain attempt to even disassociate themselves with the leaking of these documents over the weekend ought to make it abundantly clear as to what the motivations were behind this report. And so I end where I began. I'm saddened, frankly, saddened by this process. I think it's done the institution a great deal of damage. Bob Dole, in his farewell address, reminded all of us in the Senate, we're not the House of Representatives. We're the Senate, where you have to trust one another, where there should be comedy between members. That if that doesn't exist, then the institution suffers. I wish the majority had listened to the majority leader before crafting this report.
Senator O'Brien?
I think two points need to be made and reemphasized. That after 51 days of hearings, 159 witnesses, dozens more depositions, tens of thousands of documents reviewed, and tens and thousands of pages of testimony reviewed and analyzed, there is no evidence of wrongdoing by the President of the United States or the First Lady. None. Point number two. I think that the American people and their essential fairness understand the difference between an investigation and an inquisition. What we have seen by the Senate Whitewater Committee over the past 2 years has been a political inquisition. The Congress some years ago provided a process that was designed to be bipartisan, where circumstances such as the Whitewater investigation could be handled by an independent counsel. That process, as you know, is ongoing. To date, the Whitewater Counsel has had available to him 41 FBI agents. It is one of the highest priorities of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Some 81 additional support and staff members, and to date has expended some $26 million. Now that is the process that is contemplated under the law. But in point of fact, what we have seen is a legislative travesty in which, for partisan political purposes, a witch hunt has been launched. And as evidence of that, I invite your attention to several facts. Number one, alluded to by my colleague, Senator Dodd. None of us in Washington are unmindful of the fact that leaking is a part of the nature of this process. But never before in the history of any Senate investigation, and in direct violation of the language contained in the resolution authorizing the Senate Whitewater proceedings to continue, has there been such a cynical, calculated, and systematic attempt to leak this information over the weekend with the sole purpose to maximize the exposure and the potential damage that can be inflicted upon the President of the United States and the First Lady. That undermines the credibility and destroys any sense of objectivity or fairness. And number two, at 5 o'clock on Friday, a series of questions are sent to the First Lady without any prior consultation with the minority and with the request that that information be responded to by Monday morning. We have been involved in this exercise for many, many months. There's ample opportunity for those questions to have been propounded in a reasonable manner in which the minority might have been involved, in which we would have had an opportunity in an orderly process to see her responses. And number three, I would simply make the point that it is clear that this is all about politics, partisan politics, and that has been its sole operating premise. I, like my colleague from Connecticut, believe that we have done irreparable damage to the institution itself. There have been a series, historically, of investigations conducted by the Senate, and they have been conducted with objectivity, bipartisanship, and fairness. The manner in which this proceeding has continued has been the very antithesis of objectivity and fairness, and the American people need to understand what is occurring. The Senate Whitewater Committee had nothing to do with a fair investigation. Its sole purpose over the past 2 years has to seek political gain to exploit any advantage that the majority could achieve in trying to embarrass the President of the United States and the First Lady. Unfortunately, from their perspective, after all of these hearings, after all of the evidence, after all of the testimony, the conclusion is that there is no evidence of wrongdoing by the President of the United States or the First Lady.
Thank you very much, Senator Carol Mosley-Braun.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'll be brief. At the outset, I want to congratulate and commend Senator Sarbanes for his even-handed, level-headed conduct of these hearings. He has been a real stalwart and a rock through all of these very tempestuous political winds. I also want to associate myself with the remarks of my colleagues, Senator Dodd and Senator Bryan. I think the points have been well made. Let's face it, folks. This was high political drama. And the fact that this was an inquisition should be lost on no one. I am particularly, and I think there are many people who are particularly taken, if not offended, by the partisan and the hard edge of the partisan political vindictive nature of the majority attack on the First Lady, Hillary Rodham Clinton, Maggie Williams, Susan Thomas's, and the women who were associated with the First Lady. The fact of the matter is that she was singled out for special abuse by this committee in this inquisition, and it is not only unfortunate, but I think it is a very frightening aspect that a woman who has to work for her family will be subjected to this kind of excoriation at the hands of a politically motivated inquisition, as this committee unfortunately turned into. When this started, I was of the impression, as many people were, that we would have a full and complete exposition of the facts, and we would present to the American people a factual report driven by our findings. That's not what happened. It turned into a partisan exercise. And the fact is, we wound up spending almost $2 million of taxpayer money on what was essentially a political targeting related more to the election coming up than to any objective search for the truth. And that, I think, is unfortunate. It's unfortunate for the people who've had to go through this. It's unfortunate for the taxpayers. But as importantly, it's unfortunate for the Senate as an institution.
Senator Simon. Paul Simon.
And truth to the American people. We had a very solemn obligation when we began this. And for those of you really interested in sort of measuring the real story here, I ask you to measure the difference between Don Riegel's stewardship of the early part of this investigation and our mutuality of effort to try to arrive at consensus about subpoenas, areas of inquiry, and what was legitimate evidence and what was not, measured against what has happened to this committee over the course of the last year. By any measured, nonpartisan judgment, an analysis of the evidence that came before our committee does not support the wild, speculative, totally political insinuations, accusations, theories, and smear that has been thrown out by the Republicans. Are there conceivably some legitimate questions about some testimonies that came before the committee? Some may not like me for saying it, but at lower levels, conceivably some staff bunker mentality may have produced some legitimate questions. But nothing, not one answer, not one piece of evidence, not one document, legitimately allows somebody to conclude what the Republicans have tried to conclude today and has offered as a, quote, majority opinion with respect to what went on here. So I think in the final analysis, it's the Senate that is found wanting, and the Whitewater Committee that has provided the longest and most extensive inquiry in history into a sitting president that has failed fundamentally to provide the kind of dispassionate, intelligent, thoughtful kind of analysis in which people could really shed light on this. And I hope that in the course of the next days, the real analysis will look at the testimony, look at what people said. And it's extraordinary to me how on occasion we've had witnesses sit in front of us who have said one thing, and the next day we pick up the newspaper and read a conclusion totally different from what that witness said. based on a desire or need to have something damaging or speculative about the president or the first lady. No matter what testimony I might feel, I have additional questions about at a lower level, there is nothing here that suggests legitimately that somebody could draw a conclusion about the improper involvement of the first lady in this. And I think they do her and the presidency an extraordinary injustice by suggesting otherwise.
Thanks very much, John. I have one final comment, and then we'll be happy to take your questions. When we set out on this inquiry, I indicated to the staff that serve the minority that we wanted to do a thorough, fair, objective, comprehensive investigation. That we would take the facts as we found them and seek to analyze them in a rational way and draw from them reasonable conclusions. And the report that we submit today has done that. And I commend it to you. We've tried to address each of the allegations that have been raised in the course of these hearings and to address them in a sober and factual and reasoned way. And I simply want to close by expressing my appreciation, the appreciation of all the members, to Richard Benvenisti, to Neil Kravitz, Lance Cole, Glenn Ivey, Jim Portnoy, and many, many other staff members who have worked so hard through these many months to do a fair and credible job, which I feel very strongly they have done. We're ready to take your questions.